Orals.
I call it to order the joint interim committee on health insurance transition and open a work session to deal with the introduction of LC 1203 as a committee bill, strictly for the purpose of getting it moving so we can get to work on it on Tuesday, the 13th of January.
Co-chair Greenlight?
Yes, ma'am.
I move that LC 1203, dated 1-2-2015, be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Montes Anderson moves that LC 1203, dated 1-2-1-2-15, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, sir.
Just briefly, the standard caveats. I think every member here knows that this is a work in progress, and as you told us in writing previously, we should expect amendments, and we all look forward to working with you and the other co-chair to come up with the best bill possible in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Is there any other discussion? Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Bates.
Excuse. Oh, I'm sorry. That's you.
It's okay.
Excuse.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Senator Girard.
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Aye.
Representative Nathanson.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Boquist.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Kenemer.
Aye.
Co-Chair Montes Anderson.
Aye.
Co-Chair Green.
Aye. Motion passes, and I close the work session on LC 1203 and open an informational meeting on that LC. Now move toward a committee bill, and I ask our favorite counsel, Lori Freeman, to join us and point out how things have moved from the last version to this version. I noticed dated the 2nd of January, you were right at work very quickly after New Year's Day, huh?
Mr. Co-Chair, we never stop.
Ah, that's good. That's reassuring.
Your name for the record.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, Lori Freeman from Office of Legislative Counsel. And I'm just going to give you sort of a big overview, because most of the changes were in the way the bill was restructured rather than any of the particulars. The original draft and the last version of the draft incorporated all the exchange functions into the Department of Consumer and Business Services functions for regulating insurance. So we added the provisions to the insurance code. And we repealed all of the statutes relating to the exchange. There was concern expressed about keeping those functions very separate and making it very clear that the functions were separate. And so this draft took those sections back out of the insurance code, restored the exchange statutes, and then just amended those statutes to reflect the change from the exchange to DCBS. By doing that, we also needed to add some enforcement mechanisms. We added the subpoena power because the director's subpoena power only was with respect to insurance regulation. And we added on page 17 this firewall that says that employees of the insurance involved in insurance regulation can't also be involved in the exchange.
Lori, does the administrator have current subpoena power for other functions?
Mr. Chair, the director has subpoena power under 731-232 with respect to regulating insurance only. Okay, so the other sort of overall view on this is that we were very careful to try to retain all of the state requirements for the exchange so that the state will have maximum flexibility in figuring out, you know, if they need to contract with the federal government for the technology, either for the shop or for the individual exchange without having to go in and amend our statutes. And we added a provision that authorizes DCBS to contract with the federal government to perform any of its functions. So DCBS ultimately is responsible for the operation of the exchange, but they can contract with the federal government to run the technology portion. There was also on page 13, we added a section request of OHA, Oregon Health Authority, to allow them to be assigned contracts from Cover Oregon that relate to the medical assistance program. So another thing that this version does, which the other one did, but it's an important thing, is that before we had one exchange, and both individuals and small employers could purchase insurance through that one exchange. This identifies separately the SHOP exchange, the Small Health Business Options Program, so that we have one. The DCBS is responsible for administering an exchange for individuals and also an exchange for small employers. And that, again, is to give the state flexibility if we want to do our own SHOP, which we sort of kind of have a version of SHOP going on right now, or if we wanted to go over to the federal SHOP, which I understand we're not doing that, but if we wanted to, that would give us that flexibility. And then it restores the role of the Oregon Health Policy Board in making recommendations about the rate review process and about changes to the health insurance market. It does that really by deleting two statutes that were amended to take out those responsibilities. And then it expands the reporting requirements to the Legislative Assembly. So in the previous version, we had a whole separate section that said you had to report all of these various things to the Legislative Assembly. Since we restored 741.222, we just added those same reporting requirements to the existing statute. And then we also added some additional requirements for the Consumer Advisory Committee. Let's see. It was on page 7. Yeah, beginning on page 7, line 27, C, D, E, and then the F on the next page are all new in this version in terms of what the advisory committee has to report to the Legislative Assembly. And I think that's the highlights.
All right, hold on. We're apparently having some technical difficulty with sound. Let's stand at ease until we find out. We don't want to miss any of your golden words.
There's a fourth.
I'll call the meeting back to order and turn it over to our counselor.
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, I don't really have anything more to say, but I'm open to questions, please.
Okay. Are there any questions, Ms. Freeman?
Yes, sir. Mr. Co-Chair, I have a couple of questions. And assuming the recording device is working at all, restate, as we know, this is a work in progress because we had a work session and we expected amendments and look forward to working together with this. And I have actually asked some questions of counsel already, so she's not stooped by my questions here. You had mentioned we added additional reporting requirements in here, and I think I've raised in the past the issue of, you know, we have continuing appropriation in the bill, so what are the checks and balances we, the legislature, have? That's one question. And then are you comfortable from the last hearing, there's a series of federal reporting requirements that happen that are supposed to be public, and like the blueprint eventually becomes public, so on and so forth. And are there places in the new bill draft in which we, the legislature, is going to be assured that we're going to meet those standards?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, there's nothing specifically in the bill that addresses those federal reporting requirements. There are several places, though, where there's reporting. There's the Consumer Advisory Committee reports, and then DCBS itself has to do reports between September 1st, 2015 and December 31st, 2017, I think. They have to report to each interim committee of the Joint Human Ways and Means Committee and to the Senate Health Committee and the House Health Committee. There's also a requirement that the Secretary of State do audits, and the Secretary of State has to do annual financial audits and performance audits every 2 years, and then the reports of those audits go to the leadership of the House and the Senate, as well as the governor and others. So there's a lot of oversight there. And then, of course, they have the exchange has to be self-sufficient. That's what the federal law says. And so we don't give it any general fund appropriations. It gets its money from imposing charges on insurers. And so since it's a fee-based funding mechanism, as with other things, we created a fund which is continuously appropriated. But like any other fund that's continuously appropriated, they would still have to come back in to the legislature during the Ways and Means process to have an adjustment made to the expenditure limitation. So they're going to be subject to oversight with respect to the expenditure limitation.
Thank you. Follow-up question, Mr. Cutter?
Please.
As you pointed out, we're separating out, for really technical reasons and I believe federal legal reasons, the SHOP, the small business, the future small business exchange, which I think many of the members here know. I mean, we presently have in the neighborhood 195,000 individuals under small business policies elsewhere that at some point will migrate to this, either shortly or as penalties start coming in. And so am I correct that what we're authorizing DCBS or whomever in this bill to create a new IT program or a parallel IT program? And can you give us a little bit of the idea of that authority and what checks and balances we, the legislature, will have over that creation, given where we are today?
Yeah. Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Boquist, the bill is vague on that. It basically says that DCBS is responsible for making sure we have a SHOP. And so that could be the current system we have now, which is sort of a manual system. It could be allowing employers in Oregon to use the federal SHOP, or it could be implementing an IT project. Obviously, that takes money, as we've all learned. And so to the extent that they would need changes to their expenditure limitation to do that, you would have oversight. You would also have oversight in terms of the annual reporting that they have to do.
One last follow-up question, Mr. Crutcher. I did not send to you in advance, and I apologize, and it's totally a rumor on my part, but you know, this building is full
of
rumors.
Did you start the rumor?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, yeah. Official staff started the rumor, so I don't know whether it's true or not. And I'm really asking you to come back with the answer for this question. There is a rumor floating around as of this morning that portions of the bill that we have may be in abeyance or delayed because of the lawsuit with Oracle. Now, I don't know exactly what that means. Apparently it's the Attorney General's office saying that there are problems with the implementation because of the lawsuit. And I think I would only ask on behalf of all the members is that we run that rumor to ground and find out from the legislative council point of view of what that situation is. And I believe later witnesses will either testify or raise the same issue. It seems totally oblivious to me why that would be the case, but since the resources are semi-reliable, I think it's something we need to run down in the future here. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
You don't have any comment on that?
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Boquist, I haven't heard anything about that, but I'm usually the last person to hear anything around here, so.
No, I am.
Mr. Cutcher, Madam Counsel, I'll get with you afterwards and tell you what I know, but again, so it's just to check it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you for your good work on this. We'll hear from you again.
Thank you.
I would like to call up now Mr. Pat Allen.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes, sir.
Out of prudence, I'd like to have the witness put under oath, and as a caveat, Mr. Allen and I have spoke. It's not a reflection of DCBS or Mr. Allen or the future, but we have a clouded past on this particular issue, and if I had it in my druthers, we would have Oracle up here under oath instead.
Yes, indeed.
But it's not in my druthers, but I would make that request and would ask you to honor that. Thank you.
Madam Administrator, would you please administer the oath?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, would you raise your right hand? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you are about to give in the manner now pending before the Joint Interim Committee on Health Insurance Transition shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Co-chairs, my name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Happy to be here today and provide you an update of some of the testimony that we provided a month or so ago. We promised to come back and talk about some more, once we'd had the opportunity to do some more detailed project planning around this transition and talk about a little bit about what that looks like. That's what I'd like to do today. I'll also touch on a couple of issues related to the current version of LC 1203 and some of those kinds of issues. Just quickly, we have a twofold goal with what we're trying to do with this project if this bill passes and we are charged with this responsibility. One is to make sure that Oregonians' access to the current vigorous competitive marketplace that they have through the exchange continues to be available, and that Oregon, as a matter of policy, is able to maintain maximum control over its own destiny in terms of implementation of the Federal Affordable Care Act. And so throughout the draft and throughout the discussions, we've really talked about needing to take it wherever possible to make clear that this is a state-based exchange and that we have available to us a range of options for how to implement that, including, as we're currently doing, use of federal technology. I just want to kind of quickly give you an idea of how we're approaching looking at this transition work. This work can't be done without being able to work closely in partnership with the existing staff at Cover Oregon. I think I mentioned last time this is a little bit like a perpetual motion machine that's always got something important going on at any given time. There's not really a lull where work stops and we can do a transition and then start up again. And so we've needed to work very closely with them. And I need to say, under what are for the folks who remain at Cover Oregon, very, very trying circumstances. They have been demonstrating the utmost in professionalism and hard work to make this transition as smooth as possible. Our structure really is to have joint project teams on a variety of topics, budget, technology, all those sorts of things, and establish detailed plans for how those various elements of the transition will occur. I think on OLIS you've got the much more detailed project charter as well as a project plan. I don't intend to go line by line by any means through that, but just the general notion that I want to convey here is that we are working in partnership and have detailed project plans for each of the significant pieces of work and the deliverables that are necessary to get that to occur. What I want to talk about at a high level about the transition plan is this notion that I, when this discussion first started in the fall, really didn't adequately appreciate. And it's the fact that there are really three distinct pieces of work that are involved in this transition that we're going to pick up, each of which at a particular point in time, and they're really quite different from each other. The 2014 plan year, that's the plan year most significantly impacted by the website issues and the Oracle issues, is actually still underway. Oregonians have 90 days, up to 90 days after the end of the year to report a life change, and those life changes can impact their coverage during that 2014 plan year. That in turn impacts things like insurance agent commissions, which Cover Oregon for the 2014 plan year is responsible for reconciling. It also deals with the 1095 tax reporting issue that's coming up, and which has its associated set of issues around errors that were made in original calculations about those. That's work that, as you see, the bill has changed its implementation date to June 30th. That's work that will largely but not entirely have trailed off by June 30th. That's a good date to use as a demarcation point. Let me talk particularly about the tax credit issue. When these 1095 forms go out nationwide, this is not an Oregon-specific issue, There's going to be a fair amount of confusion and consternation around that. These are going to be forms that that citizens participating in this system are not used to getting. They've never seen them before. I'm given to understand that if you are used to filing a 1040 EZ form with this tax credit, this 1095, you will need to file a full 1040. That'll be a change. People will have gotten a tax credit for the year based on what their estimated income was at the time that they signed up for insurance. And now they're going to be reconciling their actual income to their estimated income. And if you've been involved in that kind of an exercise before, you know it can be extraordinarily difficult to get that number right. So there are going to be people who are going to get to the point that they do their tax bill, and it's going to be different than they expected it to be based on that reconciliation of actual to projected income. Add on top of that the Oregon twist that those some number of those credits were miscalculated, and my guess is that when people do their taxes and find out they owe money, they're going to be convinced that that was because of the miscalculation, and they're going to want to have that reconciled. It's important to note that that's a process that won't end on April 15th when people's taxes are due, because, of course, you can file for an extension and not have to file until October, and you can amend a return for a period of years after that. So there's going to be a tail on this tax credit issue that's going to go on for a length of time. Again, June 30th gets us a date where we minimize the tail, but it will continue to exist. The 2015 plan year is the one that is currently being administered by Cover Oregon, and using the federal technology, and that really is a question of picking a date that gets us through the open enrollment period and through the significant piece of work, but where there will still be a handoff of work in process that will occur. Largely that work is being done at the federal level, but not entirely. There's still call center functions and those kinds of things that will occur. And then the 2016 plan activities will begin to start. Here I've included the work that we always do at DCBS in terms of insurance rate filings and approval and those sorts of things that begins in the spring, again, to illustrate that notion of this perpetual motion machine where there's always something important going on. That work starts before the implementation date, but the idea of this project plan is that as we move to the open enrollment process for 2016, we have fully taken control of that work and are responsible for it. Again, just to put a bright line around it, three discrete and in some cases dramatically different boxes of work that go with this transition. Again, at a very high level, to give you an idea of the pacing to be ready by a July 1st transition, between now and passage of the bill, I think I said before the direction that I've given to staff is within the limits of our statutory authority, act as though this bill is passing so that we can be ready as quickly as possible to take this work on. And so we're setting up project teams, we're doing detailed budget planning, all those kinds of things that need to occur for that transition to be as smooth as possible. This is all work that if you choose not to go this direction, we can stop, and there's not a significant sunk cost that goes with it, but we need to stay as far ahead of the curve as we possibly can. In the period from February to March is when we begin to set up this independent unit within the agency that will be responsible for administering Cover Oregon. And that's just going through the ordinary work of a state agency to create and fill positions, create organizational and budget units and all those sorts of things that we would do. This is all subsequent, presumably, to passage of the bill. My understanding is that the intent is for this bill to pass fairly quickly at the beginning of session. That will be helpful to this transition process. The longer, these are things that we do actually have to wait for your action to be able to do. And so if there's a delay, that does impact our ability to implement smoothly. I won't go into more detail about this, just the notion being that by July 1st, we're fully up and running, and this has been a discussion operationally about what should the implementation date of the bill be, and we're comfortable that the currently envisioned date allows us adequate time to be able to do this structural work to get up and running by that point, but I do need to come back to that issue. So let me talk quickly about LC 1203. First, a big thanks to the Legislative Council who've been very helpful in working through the issues that we and others have raised to get us to this point. And the bill is absolutely moving in the direction of tightening up and getting a good clear focus of what we're trying to what we're trying to do. The June 30th effective date, I need to talk a little bit about. I mentioned that that's an operational date. We have been receiving advice from Department of Justice about, aside from operational constraints, what are the constraints or requirements or directions we may need the bill to take that with respect to pending litigation involving Cover Oregon. And there may be some tension between those that we have not yet resolved that we're working very quickly to get to an answer on. But there may be some direction from DOJ that says, you know, actually an earlier implementation date is more advantageous from a litigation standpoint. I apologize for sort of flagging an issue without having the remotest idea what the answer is to it, but with the expectation that there will be some sort of at least a -1 amendment to this bill early on, I want to make sure you're aware that that may be an issue that's still a little bit in flux.
There will certainly be some amendments that deal with purely technical issues, and then I expect there will be some that deal with substantive issues.
That's what I would expect as well. The other piece I want to flag for you, we're concerned about the language as it is currently structured around the so-called firewall between insurance regulation and the marketplace function. Right now, if I can paraphrase, it's something to the effect of no employee involved in the regulation of insurance can be involved in the exchange. Involved is a term I'm a little bit nervous about, and down to the individual employee level, I'm a little bit nervous. Give you a couple of reasons for that. Is my network administrator involved in the regulation of insurance? I can imagine a construct that person would be. So do I need to have a different network administrator for the exchange functions? I don't know what the answer to that would be. Right now, one of the functions that we take on is a call center function. I have an existing call center around consumer advocacy. Would this keep me from having one call center that expands to cover multiple types of calls that's involved in the regulation of insurance, but not really involved in decision making? So we need to work with the stakeholders who are interested in this issue, as well as Ledge Council, to pin that kind of thing down.
It can Senator? Wait, Mr. Chair. If that's okay. I mean, I'm sort of accumulating a list as we go. I'm happy to wait till the end of Mr. Allen's presentation. Thank you, sir.
Sorry, Mr. Allen. Go ahead.
And then the last thing, and I'll take any questions you might have. We are in the process of acquiring a quality assurance consultant to be able to oversee the actual transition project itself, make sure that we've adequately identified the risks involved and are managing those appropriately, so that we are able to have this transition be as smooth as it can possibly be and minimize any kind of a dropping of the ball along the way. With that, co-chairs, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Senator.
Thank you. Do you, Mr. Allen, or Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, have any idea when DOJ is likely to give us that guidance about implementation dates?
Yeah, Co-Chair Senator Hayward, they have provided us guidance about the fact that there is a preference that the date be earlier. What I've not been able to do is have an opportunity to sit down specifically with DOJ, and we've got that on the schedule now, I think, to really get into the issue of, is that a short-term tactical advantage, and how do we weigh that against overall business issues, or is it a huge deal that, you know, puts our position at risk, those kinds of things. I need to really get a good understanding of that before I can tell you more.
Thank you. May I ask another question? Would you prefer that I wait, sir?
No, go.
Thank you very much. With regard to the makeup of the advisory committee, I recognize that there will be substantial reporting requirements, and the Secretary of State will continue to have audit requirements, as Ms. Freeman quite rightly outlined. I have to say that, given the frequency of putting legislators on these kinds of things, I'm a little surprised that there aren't any on this one, and I wondered what your perspective would be about whether it would be problematic with different branches. I know you're not an attorney, Mr. Allen. I'm not asking you to give a legal opinion on that. But it does seem to me that close engagement by the legislature, even in an ex officio capacity, for some period of time might not be a bad idea in terms of oversight. I just was talking to Senator Girard about
legally,
that.
Legally, it's simply necessary that the statute put the legislators on
okay.
the committee. Otherwise, a legislator cannot be on an advisory committee.
Okay. I figured that was true because I'm on advisory committees for or boards for other state organization. So what's your thought about that, Mr. Allen?
Co-Chair Senator Steiner Hayward, I think aside from our strong preference that there be an advisory committee and that it be broad-based with a wide array of perspectives of all of the stakeholders of this process, I think we're fairly agnostic as to the nuts and bolts makeup of the committee, and we'd yield to your judgment on that sort of an issue.
Thank you. Then I would encourage us to consideration to including legislators, one from each chamber, or maybe even two from each chamber, one from each caucus, on the advisory committee.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, I don't want to be on that committee.
I wasn't volunteering either.
Me too.
Yeah, right, right.
I wasn't volunteering either.
See how bipartisan we were there, Mr. Co-Chair?
Yeah, we have a bipartisan agreement that you really want
to be on. Not it.
I have a couple items, Mr. Co-Chair. I would just echo what Senator Hayward said, and I know that Mr. Allen's working on it. We've talked about it, and I greatly appreciate their work and their quick flow of information that's been coming to the members, but any legal challenge to implementation, we should definitely know for in advance. Having said that, Mr. Co-Chair, I would like to go back to a couple of points Mr. Allen made. I think most of us recognize that our three choices for this are keep it as it is and cover Oregon ain't working, so we're not going to do that probably. Make it a state entity in some manner, which we're discussing here, or send it to the federal government. And my question, and I guess to Mr. Allen, is that, and I know he's been working on it, we don't have the answers, but in those three scenarios, there are tax consequences to the citizens in terms of what are the tax credits now and in the future, potentially, what are the fees presently now versus the federal government, and it would behoove the committee to have those answers before we move forward. So as example, if it did go to the feds, which is not part of this, but it did go to the feds and the tax credits were lost, we'd all like to know the impact on our constituents, especially the low-income constituents that might magically now lose a tax credit and literally see a huge tax increase. And so I'd ask for them to come back with that information, which then leads me to, I guess, the two questions I really have, Mr. Chair, and that is, what are we going to call it? What is he planning to call it in the future? Not Cover Oregon, I hope. That's one question, because that's important, believe it or not. And the second is what is their kind of intent for the shop? How the council mentioned we could do it by paper, we could do it by this way. We have about 195,000 individuals on small business policies now. What is sort of the executive branch's intent for that future shop? Is it going to be paper? Is it going to be an IT project or that sort of thing? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
As a co-chair, Senator Boquist, thank you. In terms of what we're going to call it, my off-the-cuff answer is I think you're going to call it the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Now, we'll have a name for that unit, and we haven't really spent any time at all thinking about what that name is, but it'll be something related to, a health insurance exchange program or something along those lines. But we really haven't devoted any time to thinking about that. In terms of SHOP, I think I touched on this a little bit at the last hearing. There are several moving parts related to SHOP that are still moving as we sit here today that make it difficult to say exactly what our intent is with respect to SHOP. The status of federal technology around SHOP, the status of how federal technology interacts with our existing method of setting rates in small groups, which are somewhat different in Oregon than they are in much of the rest of the country, as well as the fact that unlike the individual market, the small business market is a rolling renewal market, and so the imperative to make a decision and have something in place by a particular date certain isn't the same as it is in the individual market. The one thing I will suggest is that it would seem to me extraordinarily unlikely that we would be coming back talking about the Department of Consumer and Business Services launching some sort of an Oregon-specific technology project aimed at delivering a piece of technology to Oregonians by January 1st of 2016. That seems that it would be extraordinarily difficult to be able to pull off. So I think it's most likely that we'll be looking at some combination of use of federal technology with some implications that has for rate setting, as well as having conversations about whether January 1st needs to be the date or whether a July 1st of 16 or some other date might make more sense to buy sufficient time to do that adequately. Does that help?
I have a comment on that I think is important. We had very strong support for this whole program from small businesses, And their assumption was that they would be able to move into a defined contribution mode, which would allow a small business to come into the exchange, say, I'm willing to put $250 per employee and here's my $2,500 check, and let the employees make some decisions about which health insurance they wanted. I think that was the underlying assumption, and I feel sort of committed to trying to move in that direction, which is not the federal shop's direction at all.
Right.
So, and I hope we can keep that up, isn't
it? And a follow-up to your, Mr. As you well know, there are tax credits attached to this, too. So how we do it and where we do it affects small businesses, and those tax credits to those small businesses are even greater than the individual tax credits. And so the ability for us to shop and do like you're saying, Mr. Chair, I think is imperative in the future. And that's one of the whole reasons for retaining this, is so that we don't have businesses penalized and we don't have individuals penalized for a decision we make.
Absolutely. Representative Kennemer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You in?
I guess my comment is more just a comment. One of the underlying guidelines that we'd had is that this bill would be about making this administrative transfer and not addressing numerous and complicated policy issues. And in my read, I think we continue to succeed on that, and I just want to make that comment for the record, that I think we're endeavoring to do an administrative transition, not some major policy.
Well, and if this comes early in the session, we have time later in the session.
Well, and there will be, I'm afraid, ample opportunity, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm kind of late to this committee, and the crux of 1203 is that DCBS basically takes over Cover Oregon. I'm one of the few people probably in this building that really bothers me, and I just need your input on this. You're a regulatory agency. And you're going to need to totally do a different mindset into a management type of agency. How are you going to accomplish that?
Sure. Thanks, Co-Chair Senator Girod. I guess I would suggest that we're perhaps a bit more nuanced. We are certainly a regulatory agency, but our approach to regulation since we were created nearly 25 years ago has been an education and programming and communication as well as hardcore regulatory tools kind of an agency. To give you just one example in terms of education, our work through Oregon OSHA focuses, there's a whole section of that program that's involved with consulting with businesses around safety practices to deal with how to protect their workers, and it's not a regulatory function at all. In terms of operating a program in the Building Codes Division, we operate a first of its kind in the nation online building permit system that's a 10-year, $50 million IT project you've never heard about because it's come off very smoothly, and delivering that program is a part of what is the core function of the agency. So, yes, this is not strictly regulatory in nature, but I think it fits with the day in and day out work that we do in the agency.
Follow up.
In your answer, you didn't really give anything about management. I'm talking about promotion, dealing with different set of labor, going out and promoting Cover Oregon to make sure that we get the people in there that's going to pay for it, like the younger groups. It's not about OSHA, and that's my point. It's not about regulatory agencies. It's about going out and doing something that's totally different. And I hate to say it, but I really DCBS would probably be the next to the last place I'd put it, but that's just me. So
where would you
go? What would be the last?
Where would be the last place I put it? Probably under the governor's direction.
But where would you put it?
I would put it as a subsidiary of SAFE, if you want to know.
Thank you.
And I have one question for the co-chairs, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Is this going to have a Ways and Means referral or not?
My understanding is that we will have fiscal authority in this committee.
Okay.
So we will have to be dealing with the fiscal as well as the substance. Is that
really?
The way you read it, Senator?
I thought it would have gone back.
I don't know.
That's what I've heard. We'll see. That's what I've
heard. Okay.
I've heard the same thing.
Representative Davis?
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Director, for your testimony. Perhaps I missed it, but do you have an idea at this point of the size of the division for the exchange that would be operating and what your budgetary requirements would be?
Yeah, thanks, Co-Chairs. Representative Davis, I'm not prepared today, particularly given that I'm under oath, to give you a...
Good job.
Give you a full fiscal impact. I would say that...
To the nearest 100 is fine.
I would say that two things. First, that what we have worked very hard to do is to assure ourselves of the fact that that we are able to deliver the program within the constraints of the existing level of assessment that's currently being charged, and we are comfortable with that. I think if you think of an ordinary division of DCBS being somewhere north of 100 people, in most cases we're not anything like that size, and so even thinking of this as a division may be a bit of a misnomer. That's why I've tried to use the word unit as we think about this. My understanding is that Cover Oregon's going forward plan calls for a staff of about 45, and depending on how you think about whether call center functions are directly delivered by DCBS or contracted elsewhere, I think we're certainly well within that sort of a size. But again, I'm not prepared today to be able to talk specifically about FTE or dollars, and to the extent that we will when we do a fiscal in February.
Follow up.
Yes, go ahead.
And again, sorry to press for details, but in terms of the structure of the unit, would it have a single manager? And what levels of management do you expect in this? Because I think one of the concerns, both from our perspective, from those who have dealt with Cover Oregon, is sort of a lack of, we discussed last committee, lack of a buck stops here. And while it certainly would stop with you as the director, the day-to-day implementation and management would have to be delegated, I presume, to the manager of that unit.
Sure, Co-Chairs, Representative Davis. Absolutely, I would reiterate, as you just did, that the buck stops with me. I am accountable for the delivery of this program. But as you say, part of why I've been interested at the outset to having a separate unit responsible for this work is to have this work that it has a singular focus within the organization, with a senior level manager who's responsible for delivering this program and not responsible for anything else in addition to that. That was one of the challenges to me of trying to assign this to the insurance division, is the insurance commissioner is responsible already for a broad array of functions, not just in health insurance, but in property and casualty and a wide array of other issues. And I felt that ran the risk of diluting focus on successful delivery of this program. So it would be a senior level manager directly accountable to me for managing the unit and being responsible for delivery of this program. Does that help?
That's very helpful. And one more follow-up, Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. And I don't think you'll have the answer to this right now, but perhaps LFO or at the next hearing, you can talk to us about, based on the enrollments that we saw and that we are seeing, what the monthly assessment level we expect to be in that fund.
Yes, thank you. We'll be in a position to be able to do that in February.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Haywood?
Was Representative Kenny Geyer ahead? Okay. Representative Davis, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davis' question does lead me to a question that I'm not sure you can answer, Mr. Allen, but maybe the co-chairs can, or Ms. Freeman. If currently the construct is that we have 75,000 people, give or take, insured through the exchange, individuals.
It's 81,000.
81. Thank you, Mr. Chair. 81,000. Smallish number. In theory, as the economy, we hope, changes and more people become less reliant on public assistance, people will be moving off the Oregon Health Plan and into either employer-based through a larger employer or a shop mechanism or everything. Does this bill, as it's currently drafted, give DCBS enough flexibility that if there's a big switch over quickly, that you're going to be able to staff up or adjust assessments appropriately as needed? Or do you think that's not going to be necessary? Do you think that you're going to require about the same amount of staff, almost regardless of how many people are using the exchange? Was that question at all intelligible?
Yeah. No, it is. Co-chairs, okay. Senator Sharon Hayward. I guess I would say two things. I'm not at all prepared to be able to say if we end up with twice the population, what would the staffing look like for that. However, what I would suggest is the accountability you get through expenditure limitation and our need to come to the legislature to be able to accommodate that staffing It does a couple of things. It means that we need to actually talk about what our plans are and why they are and why we've, if we're proposing a ramp up of staffing or any other expenditures to you, why we have to do that. And the fact that you are here on an annual basis actually does give us a degree of flexibility to be able to come in the off session with a budget adjustment driven by exactly those kinds of circumstances.
Okay.
It's not exactly, you know, private sector nimbleness. It's year by year, but I think that you've got both the ability to respond reasonably quickly, as well as the oversight ability to make sure you're comfortable with the choices that we're making. Is that at all helpful?
Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Allen. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kagar.
Yeah, thank you. I was just going to say one thing in general. I was pleased to see that this LC incorporated some of the comments that had come up in the last hearing that we had around including advisory members and including report backs about feedback mechanisms and hard-to-reach populations. So I just want to get that on the record. One of the questions I have is not just so much what's in the LC here and where we want to go starting at the effective date, but also the transition between now and then. You had a slide in the beginning that talked about transition teams and working with Cover Oregon, and I want to be really sure that we capture any lessons gained from the past. And so I wondered if you could just describe a little bit how you're meeting with the current director of Cover Oregon and the board chair and the board, and who is really responsible for decision making. I'm assuming still Cover Oregon up until the point that this takes place. So how is the flow of information? How are the decision making?
Certainly. Co-chairs, Representative Kinnegar, it is as you describe, it's a shared decision making environment. The bill the bill itself is structured to imagine sort of a staged transition. Mm-hmm. on becoming effective with an emergency clause, the board goes away and I become the decision making authority for Cover Oregon. Cover Oregon staff is working extensively with us through Executive Director Aaron Patnode and an array of people who've been involved very closely on a literally daily basis with us in dealing with these transition issues. The bill also envisions my having authority to begin implementing the terms of the bill ahead of the effective date. I think one of the challenges that we are going to face is as Cover Oregon moves closer and closer to ceasing to exist as an organization, we're going to have staff that are going to get other jobs and those kinds of things, and we're going to need to be able to deal somewhat nimbly with how we manage those kinds of issues. I think the Cover Oregon staff has been working admirably with us on trying to manage those transitions and try to deal with those issues as we move forward. Is that what you were?
So just a follow-up question.
Yeah, let me ask a follow-up too as a part of that. I mean, we could be able to move some of those people over. Is the assumption is every one of them is fired in there?
Our assumption is that there are key skills and key pieces of knowledge with staff at Cover Oregon that while we'll go through a standard but nimble state process of adding people, and there are no sort of guaranteed roles. There's going to be some combination of people who are extremely well qualified and have specified knowledge are going to be very well positioned to move into roles that'll be analogous at DCBS. It's also likely, and this is a bit speculative, but as we work through with Department of Justice the notion of what the effective date of the bill needs to be, if the answer is it needs to be sooner, we may need to, as a piece of that, come up with some kind of a structure that allows us to have people become temporary employees from the time of that hastened effective date to something like July 1. We may need to be a little bit creative with how we try to create that so that we don't have that loss of critical skills and critical knowledge through the implementation process.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Thank you. So much of the decision making right now rests in the board of Cover Oregon, not just the director, but the board overseeing them. So is there regular communication with that board up until the point that you transition over? Is there a flow of information going to that board? Is there a regular meeting with the chair?
Sure. Co-chairs, Representative Kinnegar. So I'm a member of that board by statute. As well, you'll see in the project plan that the co-chair of the board and I are the co-sponsors of the transition project, and we are communicating with the board and dealing with decision-making issues that need to happen between now and the presumed passage of the bill to try to address that.
And one more follow-up. Will the advisory committee, what's your timeline thinking on when the advisory committee will actually be appointed and starting to function?
Co-chairs, Representative Kenny Geyer, I don't actually have that date on the off the top of my head. I shouldn't speculate under the current circumstance, so I'll have to get back to you.
Thank you.
You can speculate as long as it's defined as speculation.
I think it's before July 1st, but I would need to confirm that.
Thank you.
Maybe a counselor can nod. No. Okay. Are there any other questions? Yes, ma'am. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for the hard work you guys are doing. We really appreciate it. We'll try and get your bill as fast as you can.
Thank you.
There has been some question about how to deal with the funds, technically. We've asked Mr. Rocco, who has some strong feelings about this, to come and join us and explain what the issues are that we'll be dealing with in the current version of the bill or in any alternative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ken Rocco with the Legislative Fiscal Office.
You might also clarify how we would work with you if we do have fiscal authority.
Very well, I think.
Oh, that was very politic.
You're not on the road.
That was nice.
Mr. Co-Chair, can we talk about these oaths again here?
And as to your other statement about having strong feelings, just to let you know what happened during the preparation of the LC draft and the planning for the transition of Cover Oregon from an independent entity into the Department of Consumer and Business Services, we were asked to look at the draft and comment on anything we saw on the financial side of that draft. And given the recent history of the exchange and our perceived view that everyone wants some transparency and accountability, we suggested including a section to establish a separate and distinct fund for the assessment dollars coming in to pay for the exchange. We're usually able to monitor agency expenditures through our budget system. It's called ORBITS. It stands for the Oregon Budget Information Tracking System. And we do that by any time there's a unique program, division, unit, whatever you want to call it, we can establish something we call a summary cross-reference or an SCR. And what that means is then all agency expenditures related to that program, division, or unit are tracked separately from the rest of the agency. So we're pretty good on the expenditure side. That ORBITS system and the SCR allows budget analysts in the legislative branch or in the executive branch to go in and keep monitoring what's going on the expenditure side. The revenue side's a little trickier because we don't have a unified system like that. We don't have a SCRs or anything. And the way we found to be able to track revenues separately is by creating a new fund or a dedicated fund for the revenues that are coming in for a program. We don't think this creates a burden on the agency. We think it actually protects an agency because it prohibits commingling of funds so that we can be confident that building code division funds are not being used to pay for health insurance exchange programs because they're separately tracked and kept apart. And we don't mean this to be a negative reflection on the department at all because they're very competent at what they do. They have multiple funding streams, multiple programs, so it's not a negative reflection on them. It's something we would recommend regardless of the agency if you have a unique program that you need to track separately. So we also checked with the treasurer. They have no issues with establishing a separate fund. They're the state's banker. They establish funds and accounts all the time. The costs to maintain this are minimal. And we had the treasurer review the language in your LC draft, and they let us know that they have no concerns with it, and they can do exactly what you're expecting from it. So basically, we just thought that this would be the best way to make sure that there's an ability to answer any questions you may have about how much money is being collected, how much has been used, and how much is left for ongoing program costs. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Miller Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've sort of had concerns about establishing a treasury fund, and I one of the main reasons is meeting payroll. You know, Cover Oregon had a problem because of the pass-through of money. Sometimes the carriers hadn't gotten the money, and yet we had a lot of insurance agencies and navigators that weren't able to be paid. Now, maybe that's going to go away this time, but the advantage of having, what is it, this fund would be starting $6 million?
Madam Chair, I believe there would be about $6 million of carry forward, and then that doesn't all, but that does not include the assessment dollars that would come in on an ongoing basis, and it also doesn't include some potential federal grant money that would be there initially, depending on when the effective date occurs.
Right. There are a lot though of unknowns, and so at least initially, to me, I would like to be able to meet a payroll and have the flexibility. We know we're going to get paid. We know that we're going to have a fund coming in some way, somehow. But to not be able to pay the people that are signing people up, et cetera, that we had in the past, $6 million doesn't seem like a large a fund. What is the normal average fund, treasury funds that we have?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, we have funds from all different lots of sizes. I mean, you have agencies whose entire budget is only $300,000 or $400,000, and so they would have a much smaller fund, and they all have separate and distinct funds in the Treasury. That's just the structure of it. So I don't think that is a real concern at this point in time. And the $6 million would be there as a beginning balance, and then, as I said, there would be an ongoing flow of revenue into the fund to cover payroll and other costs.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Could we have the director of DCBS come back up and get his thoughts on a treasury fund?
Mr. Allen, can you join us, please? And just a reminder, you'll still be under oath. My understanding is going forward in 2015 on, the agents are going to be paid directly by the insurance companies.
And that could be.
That's right. So that'll take some of that pressure, won't it?
Mr. Chair, if I may, I would just say that part of the problem with paying agents related not to cash flow but to assignment and attribution, which is a problem in all sorts of parts of the world. I mean, it's a problem between insurance companies and providers. It's a problem between insurance companies and agents. So my understanding from talking to a lot of insurance agents is that it was much more around attribution when things didn't get entered into the system properly, and therefore insurance companies didn't know who to pay.
But up until 2015, the money came from the insurance companies to the exchange, and the exchange to the agents. Going
yes.
forward, for the agents, that's not true for the navigators or whatever we call them now, but for the agents, they'll be paid directly by the insurance companies. So that won't flow through this fund, as I understand it.
But it'll continue to be an issue if the attribution isn't correct.
Yeah, that'll be their problem, though. It won't be the exchange's problem.
That's true. But it's still an issue for people, small businesses.
Mm-hmm. Co-chairs, members, again, Patrick Allen with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Not so much an opinion on the proposed structure as simply an observation that currently we push about $400 million a biennium of revenue and expenditure, which for us more or less tend to balance out by the nature of the structure of the agency, through largely two treasury accounts. Those are themselves made up of a myriad of statutorily dedicated revenue streams and funds. Mr. Rocco mentioned building codes. Building codes itself has seven or eight different dedicated funding streams, which have some degree or other of firewall. You can imagine banks and credit unions aren't thrilled about their dollars being commingled, and those are statutorily dedicated funds as well. And so in terms of the scope of what we're talking about, these are really important dollars, and they're significant dollars. It's really a fairly small increment to what we currently do and manage, I think, with excellent transparency and with a strong track record of maintaining fund separation through the Worker Benefit Fund and the Consumer and Business Services account as our two main treasury accounts.
Well, yeah, I still would like to have a better idea. I don't want us to get in the same problem that we had with Cover Oregon, and it was months and months, and whether some of these problems are going to go away, that is one thing, but can you give an advantage of not having a treasury fund, designated treasury fund?
Co-chairs, by virtue of the fund size that we have now, which in each of our two main funds is on the order of about $100 million, it allows us to have a meaningful conversation with Treasury about risk and investment returns. And we're not out, you know, playing the stock market. Our funds are invested quite conservatively, but at better than money market rates, and so we're able to yield. To yield returns that in the main are meaningful as a contribution to programs. A $6 million fund balance would be much, much more difficult to be able to do on that sort of a basis. Similarly, we've got some statutory flexibility between dedicated accounts within a fund that allows us to deal potentially with cash flow issues should they arise, that would be somewhat different in a dedicated account.
Could I have a follow-up for Mr. Rocco?
Yes,
please. Thank you. Mr. Rocco, if I recall, because I remember I was two sessions ago, I lived and breathed other funds. I think that was it, right? And the Treasury. Am I correct, if I remember right, once we do expenditure authority in a lot of these funds, then the Treasury or agencies still, even in a dedicated fund, have for better word, financing opportunities, because fees don't come in on a normal basis, if I recall correctly. And so Treasury is kind of, as you said, the banker. He knows that we have an accounts receivable coming in, and so he helps us out to manage those funds. And in a dedicated fund, to some extent, that still exists, even though it's, as you point out, more difficult, or as Mr. Allen points out, a little more difficult, because you got to go ask the Treasury, hey, you know, we got to do this. But is there not some flexibility in there, if I recall correctly?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, yes, there is considerable flexibility, and I don't think the Treasury goes out and invests each individual account that exists in the Treasury, because, as I said, there are some very small accounts, and they're part of the overall general fund, which in Treasury's world, the general fund is not like when we budget general fund dollars. They use general fund to mean all of these accounts that are in as part of the Treasury. So there is, on the Treasury's standpoint, there's a lot of flexibility on investment and doing other things. So, yes, you're correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Co-chair?
Yes. So if there isn't money in the if there isn't enough money for cash flow to happen in at a certain point in time, you're saying there's flexibility to bring money from somewhere else?
I think there's just, Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, I think there is flexibility to cover those kinds of issues because the monies are still dedicated to the department, so they do have flexibility to do that. And I keep hearing $6 million. Well, that's just the beginning balance that's going to be started with. And then there's going to be $8 million. I think the estimate is at least $8 million a year in assessment dollars that are going to be coming in to finance this program. And I think all we're trying to do is just to make sure that if you ask the question, how much money has been collected and how much money do they have left to spend, that answer can be easily given. Now, on a totally separate exercise that we asked the department to do on other fund balances not too long ago, they gave us here's our balance. It's over $100 million in the one fund that Mr. Allen was mentioning. And we said, well, can you break that down for us by your individual funding streams? And they said, yes, but it'll take us 2 weeks to do that. And we just don't know if that's an adequate timing for you. If you ask me tomorrow how much is in that account and how much have they spent, I don't want to tell you, well, I'm going to wait 2 weeks and give you an answer. I'd rather do it much quicker than that. So,
yeah, I just don't want to set up barriers to a perceived maybe cash flow problem that might happen.
Mr. Chair, could I comment quickly on that? I just to not leave the wrong impression. I think that 2 week answer that the Legislative Fiscal Office received may have been impacted by the request coming at the end of the year and around the holidays as well.
Senator Gray?
Yeah, thank you. I'm just of the belief that cash flow is extremely important. And when I sat on Ways and Means Sub for Education, we oversaw a lot of boards, and we evened out the cash flow by making the policy date, in this case, the birthday, so that it doesn't all come in at one time, and then you got to manage that over the period of time. So, I mean, that's something you might look at.
But they can't because of open enrollment, can they?
Okay, well.
So, well, the open enrollment, you would have it at a different period of time. You just can't have it for 30 days.
But that's not, well, we'd have to regroup on everybody then, which is okay. I'm just saying.
One of my learned colleagues reminded us periodically that if we were on a dead horse, we should get off. I think we may be time to get off this particular
dead
horse.
That's a good analogy, sir.
Thank you both very much for joining us.
Mr. Chair, and if you might allow me, I was looking over the draft, and if you're taking suggestions on technical things, I just wanted to point out something on page 20 of your draft. There's a report, and that the language says that the director or Mr. Allen should report this information at each scheduled meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means and of the interim committees related to health between September 1, 2015 and June 30th, 2017. The Ways and Means Committee meets like once a week during session, so I think given considerations of Mr. Allen's time, you might want to look at that. And
Council, will you note that? Okay. Thank you very much,
thank
Mr.
you.
Rocco.
Thanks.
It's now time to move to public testimony. We have about five people that have signed up. Administrator, would you call the first panel, please?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair. Tom Holt, Jessica Adamson, and Inga Deckert, please.
You know, Mr. Holt is trying to curl in favor with the co-chair by mimicking his motive draft.
We got the same memo today, I think. For the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. And in light of what's going to happen next week, I should note that the color of my sweater does not mean that I favor Ohio State. Actually, originally come from Michigan, where we have bumper stickers about Ohio State. That testify on the record about.
I've had those bumper stickers.
In regard to the LC, concur with others who've already commented that
you need to introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions.
Oh, you did. Okay.
Generally, we think it's headed in the right direction. Like others, we're still in the process of reviewing a lengthy bill with a lot of technical change, not policy changes, but just technical things we want to make sure are correct and haven't had the opportunity to get quite all the way through it. I think all of us planning to get all of our comments together in one document to provide to Sandy here very soon. But a few things that we have found on our first pass through that we think may need some attention, either with bill language or perhaps through a budget note process, given that this committee will have the fiscal authorities. One, just making clear that the Medicaid call center functions are going to get paid for by the Medicaid program and not by insurance policy assessments. And I think in terms of intent, we're all in agreement. We've had some brief conversation with Mr. Allen about that, and we'll be working with him and his team on some other things. The advisory board language, we think, still needs a little bit of work. We think that the creation of a broad advisory board with people who have expertise in the areas that the insurance exchange will cover is a good move. However, at another point later in the bill, the old language from the board of the current insurance exchange is carried over, and for the board, no board member can have any financial interest or employment in insurance, selling insurance, healthcare delivery, etc. And so that conflict language probably needs to come out. The firewall language, Mr. Allen pointed out, needs a little bit of work, and we'll be happy to work with him on that. I think we all intend the same thing. It's just a matter of getting the words down. And the fourth item, I have one more after that, just dealing again with making sure that we aren't doubly assessing insurance policies for functions that the federal government is assessing on, and the state would also is going to have its function. So we need to talk about how we handle that, and that may well be something to be dealt with budget note language rather than bill language, but we'll dig into that with Mr. Allen's team. And I want to speak a minute about this separate account issue. Senator Miles Anderson, I think we believe that the problems that were visible on that in recent months were more administrative than substantive. Certainly when we get a bill for a commission from CoverOregon today, we pay that, and then the agent gets paid by CoverOregon, and there is a lag there. There were some technical issues in sorting out, you know, which agents were responsible for selling which policies, and we think that's been straightened out now. That said, we think it's very important to have a separate account, really for all the reasons that Mr. Rocco mentioned, of making it clear where the money is coming from and where it's going. But I would add that there is a requirement in the Affordable Care Act that exchanges be self-sustaining. And we believe that having a separate account is the surest way to be able to prove to the federal government, if questioned, that it is in fact self-sustaining. So we would strongly recommend following Mr. Rocco's advice on that point. In general, again, we're continuing to review the bill. We hope to complete that work in the next few days, and then we're planning to sit down with Mr. Allen, with others, to make sure that we've all collectively identified things. I don't hear any disagreements, really, about direction or the technical issues. I think anything that we've found so far is in the range of technical issues, as Representative Kenmer mentioned, and I think was mentioned in the last hearing on this. You know, the intent is a technical move here, and we're not looking for policy issues either.
Please copy Ms. Freeman and the co-chairs through the committee administrator on any documents you share. It'd be very helpful for us.
We will do that, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. We want to start by just thanking the committee staff, as well as the Senate President's office and the Speaker's office, for reaching out to us, really seeking our input, and then the draft, which really encompassed the vast majority of the issues that we raised, were resolved, and we are really appreciative of the working relationship and the ability to address what we view, again, are technical issues in a really comprehensive draft. And so we, too, are continuing to evaluate the draft, would echo the comments that Mr. Holt just made. And one additional point on the fund, underline the point that we believe it's important to have a separate fund. One of the reasons for that is that the bill does require that if collections are in excess of what's necessary to run the agency, that there is a reduction in charges in the following quarter, so that the fund is self-sustaining, but also if the assessments exceed the amount necessary to run that entity, that those charges are reduced so that we can pass those savings on to our customers. So we believe it's very important to have a separate and distinct fund for all of the reasons that Mr. Holt indicated and others as well. So thank you very much for seeking our input, for accommodating our requests, and we look forward to continuing to move forward on this important bill.
Did I hear you say that if there's a quarterly reduction in assessments from the exchange that you'll immediately pass those savings on to your customers?
Mr. Chair, I didn't mean to imply that that will add an immediate impact, but that over time, as we go through the next process, that that is something that will be able to be adjusted over time.
I just didn't want to be confused.
I apologize if I was unclear, Mr. Chair.
I was waiting for that check.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Co-Chair Mona Anderson, members of the committee, Inga Deckert for Kaiser Permanente. I just want to reiterate Kaiser's support for the points that were brought forward by both Mr. Holt and Ms. Adamson. We agree with them wholeheartedly, including the fact that the fund be set up as a separate and distinct fund in the Treasury for the purposes that were stated. And I just have one additional comment to add, and that's around the SHOP. I was happy to hear that there was so much discussion around the Small Business Exchange and the creation of the SHOP. One way that you may be able to track that a little bit better is to include some reporting requirement about the SHOP in DCBS's reports to the legislature. That may be one way. I mean, initially they may not have a lot about the details of it because it hasn't been up and running, but at least as far as looking forward and what are some potential timelines in the development of the SHOP as we move forward.
Any questions of this panel? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The question, and I think that Mr. Holt brought up a really big point, and that is the language for the firewall. You've heard some of my comments before. You have a regulatory agency. How that firewall is constructed, I would think, would give you is very important. I don't know how you could possibly do it. I mean, that's the big gripe that I have with having it in DCBS. Do you have some sample language that you have so that we can improve the firewall?
Co-Chair Greenlick and Co-Chair Moss Anderson, Senator Girod, we're planning to sit down with Mr. Allen's team in the next several days to figure that out. I think conceptually we're all on the same page of the importance of that. We really appreciate the thoughtfulness that Mr. Allen is putting into operationalizing this and awareness of sort of the cultural issue of putting what in some sense is a marketing organization and into an agency that also has broader regulatory functions. But we're very confident based on all the conversations that have happened so far that, you know, this is something that's going to get a lot of attention, and we'll figure out some language. We don't have the magic language in our hands at this point. We've been trading some ideas around, but we'll get it worked out.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. I just want to thank industry for the participation, but also point out, as Mr. Good Representative Vice Chair Kennemer said, you know, we have a plan here and we're going to kind of leave some details in it, but we're going to move forward and we've left the station. And I think we've all seen that this is frankly, a revolutionary process in the legislature. We're moving faster than I've ever seen this happen ever before. And so, industry, my only advice to you is yesterday.
Sign the die, we move very fast.
That's right.
That's true.
So time is of the essence, because this is moving, correct, co-chairs, rather fast. So we should move quickly on anything we want to do.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have a couple more?
We do. Do you want to bring
them? Yeah, you
can. Next is Jesse O'Brien and Tim Cowan.
If there's anybody else, but our assistant, no.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the healthcare advocate with OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, a statewide consumer group. I also serve on the Cover Oregon Consumer Advisory Committee. I just have some brief comments. We submitted prior to, first of all, I should say, we're broadly supportive of the LC and the direction that it looks like the committee is going, for the record. We submitted some comments prior to the new year on the previous draft. I think our comments have been incorporated into the new draft adequately, so we're happy with that. But I wanted to briefly touch on what we commented on. Our comments mostly focused on the composition and role of the advisory committee, which we think is really important, because it's going to be the place where the forum where the public can weigh in and provide feedback and create some sort of feedback loops with the policy decisions of the exchange. So it's really important that it reflect all of the stakeholders adequately, and that it is empowered to weigh in on all of the key issues regarding the governance structure and policies of the exchange. And we just think it's important that, to state for the record, that advisory committee should be empowered to advise the exchange on the full range of issues having to do with implementing its mission. And its mission, as laid out originally in Senate Bill 99, is not just about running an agency. It's not just about setting up a website and enabling enrollment. It's also about taking steps to make healthcare itself work better for Oregon consumers and small businesses, including by improving quality, reducing cost, improving affordability, improving access. And we want to make sure that the advisory committee is empowered to weigh in on all of those issues and to report back on progress on those issues to the legislature. And we think that the current draft does a good job of that. I also wanted to briefly address the issue raised by Mr. Holt earlier about the conflict of interest language being carried over from the board. Those of you with long memories may remember that OSPIRG was very strongly in favor of having strong conflict of interest language with regard to the board membership. But we're actually totally on board with, as it were, removing that for the advisory committee, because the role of the advisory committee is different. It's not an executive committee. It's not the place where the policy decisions are being made, and it's completely appropriate for people who work for the industry to have a voice in that advisory committee, provided that, you know, there are at least some representatives on the advisory committee who do not have conflicts of interest. And I think the current language reflects that just fine by requiring there to be consumer representatives and people who represent the interests of enrollees in health plans, navigators, etc. Those are my comments on the draft so far. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Is it safe to assume that this committee will require to meet public meeting law?
Yeah, I think so. If it's set in statute, doesn't it automatically require for public meeting law?
Well, we can check that with our counselor.
Right. Yeah.
In time,
but
for
I don't think so.
We would certainly want that to be the case.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, I mean, just a quick comment. Mr. O'Brien, I completely appreciate your concern about the conflict of interest and overall agree, but I would argue pretty strongly that anybody who lives in the state has a conflict of interest at some level, because we're all going to be touched by this. We've all been touched by the debacle with Cover Oregon, whether that's how we get our health insurance or not. Certainly every legislator has, big time. And every consumer, I mean, potentially in the long term, most of us could be getting our insurance through the exchange. So I think the question is more not about avoiding conflict of interest, but balancing interests, if I may be so bold as to offer a different way to think about it.
I think he said it didn't need the conflict of interest language. I think he's agreeing.
Okay, I just want to be sure. You just said at the end, as long as there were some people who didn't have conflicts of interest.
Co-chairs, Senator Sander Hayward, that point is very well taken. Our support for conflict of interest language in Senate Bill 99 was premised on the idea that the board would be making decisions about things like what the standards should be for participating health insurance plans, and that it was actually where the buck stopped for those decisions. And if there was, for example, just one insurance company that was represented there, that could create a problem. If all of the members of that board were insurance company representatives, that could potentially create a problem. But this advisory board is really a different creature, and we're happy with the way it's laid out in the current LC.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lori Freeman, Legislative Council. The conflict of interest provisions only apply to employees of DCBS who are administering the program. The members of the advisory committee are not employees, so the conflict of interest provisions would not apply to the advisory committee.
Okay. Excellent. Wait, while you're sitting there, is it safe to assume open meeting laws will apply?
Yes, these would qualify as open meeting or subject to open meeting law.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Jesse. Yes, sir.
My name is Tim Cowan. I'm testifying in two capacities. One is an individual, and the other one is a citizen's lobbyist. I added this at the last minute because of Senator Girard's comment. I was asked to help look at policy on the governor assigning the board and the board reviewing the investment staff, and then the treasurer. What does the treasurer do? I went over the archives, reviewed that, looked at a number of different things, and it seemed too easy. So my comment was, it's cash flow. The treasurer provides a requirement for cash flow so the investment staff can invest. Guess what the comment was? They wouldn't include it because you wouldn't understand it. And, Chairman, I would tell you who that is in private because I don't want to do it in public. Now, going back to, I have two recommendations, and I want to give you a qualification first. The first one is, I was an intervener on a petition to the Land Use Board of Appeal. It involved the city and the hospital. They're a nonprofit. They have a lot of money, and we had to compete with no money and couldn't afford an attorney. Now, as a result of that, since a couple items were remanded back to the city, we're going to the Court of Appeals. And some of my testimony went into the petition. Here's what I learned. One, there's a fundamental difference between the administrative staff of a hospital and the quality of care. And because it's administration, it's just like a corporation. They're interested in things that help the corporation, and they have the money as a nonprofit to do what they want to do. So here's my recommendations. One, continue some type of overview of the hospitals when you look at your legislation. Number two, also take into consideration the impact of that on independent physicians. Because my experience has been, they'll do what they think they want to do. And the quality of care is great. Don't commingle them. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both very much. Seeing no other witnesses coming forward. We will stand adjourned. We're going to be wait a minute.
Before we adjourn, do we need to take any action on this draft to forward it so that it's prepared as a bill for the upcoming session?
We did that. That was the opening.
I missed the opening.
You voted yes.
I did vote yes, and I recalled that. I didn't understand the full implications of it.
We did that first to make sure everybody understood.
There we go. Yes, thank you.
We will, I think, as I remember, meet on the 13th at 5:30.
Mr. Chair, is it the 3rd or the 13th?
The 3rd, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
The 3rd, not the 13th. We do not meet on the 13th. We met today.
Is the 13th a Friday?
We'll get it together.
It's a Tuesday.
Mr. Chair, I guess you're going to get back to the committee members and Madam Co-Chair on do we have fiscal authority or what's the plan?
I think it is clear we do have fiscal authority.
I did receive a text while testimony, and let me just pull it up and I will read it exactly as I received it. LFO is with the committee, this committee, no ways and means.
We'll have multiple staffs. There is hope that we will be able to move this bill very quickly.
I liked your dead horse analogy better.
All right.
But you can always eat a horse. You can't eat a mule. So.
Oh.
What are we, adjourn your committee?
Well, it's a joint.
All right. We are adjourned. Thank you.